Even among those who believe that the war on Afghanistan was part of the so-called war on terrorism, there's a fairly wide recognition that the outcome, the occupation of Afghanistan, might have something to do with the ambitions of U.S. oil corporations. Which brings us to the connection between September 11th and the oligarchy. Let me start with a crash course in globe oil reality, a framework little mentioned by the mainstream media. First, the size and power of big oil. Together, oil and coal constitute the biggest single industry in history, writes Ross Gelbspan in his book, The Heat Is On. Big oil alone does well over $1 trillion a year in business. Second, we're at the end of the petroleum era. Total world oil extraction is peaking. These charts from Scientific American and other equally reliable sources tell the story. And the supply does not drop off gently. If you think this industry is rich and powerful now, wait till the supply is clearly on the wane. At the website www.dieoff.com, you can learn that in 1995, Petro Consultants published a report for oil industry insiders at $32,000 a pop, titled World Oil Supply 1930 to 2050, which concludes that world oil extraction could peak as soon as the year 2000 and decline to half that level by 2025. Large and permanent increases in oil prices were predicted after the year 2000. Black gold is going to go platinum. Well, wait. We'll just switch to other energy sources, right? Wind, solar, biomass, tidal? Wrong. All the alternatives in the world, writes former U.S. Army officer and political analyst Stan Goff, cannot begin to provide more than a tiny fraction of the energy base now provided by oil. This makes it more than a resource, and the drive to control what's left more than an economic competition. Most experts agree, writes Larry Chin in Online Journal, that the Caspian Basin and Central Asia are the keys to energy in the 21st century. Energy expert James Dorian in the Oil and Gas Journal, those who control the oil routes out of Central Asia will impact all future direction and quantities of flow and the distribution of revenues from new extraction. In other words, a pipeline through, of all places, Afghanistan, needed to carry an estimated $5 trillion worth of Caspian oil and gas reserves to markets. A significant detail that surely is not lost on those in power in the United States. So just who are these people? Let's start with the occupant of the Oval Office himself. George W. Bush was CEO of Harkin Energy. George Herbert Walker Bush, his dad and the former president, was an oil man. Now he's on the board of the Carlyle Group, which is heavily invested in oil and armaments. Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense during Desert Storm. He stepped down to become CEO of Halliburton Oil, cashed in $34 million in Halliburton stock options before taking office as vice president. Donald Evans, Bush's Commerce Secretary, was with Colorado Oil. Zalmay Khalilzad is the Bush-appointed special envoy to Afghanistan. Khalilzad previously was an aide to the American oil company Unocal. He drew up Unocal's risk analysis on its proposed trans-Afghan gas pipeline. Khalilzad reports to Condoleezza Rice, Bush's national security advisor. When she was a board director of Chevron Corporation, she served as its principal expert on Kazakhstan, where Chevron holds the largest concession of any of the international oil companies. Khalilzad will liaise with the new Afghani leader, Hamid Karzai, a former consultant to Unocal. You get the idea. A General Motors president once said, "Structure is strategy in slow motion." The structure of this cabinet shows, in my opinion, the primacy of oil interests. How does this connect with the events of 9/11? Well, it's hard to just invade a country out of the blue, I believe. The perfect pretext is a so-called war on terrorism, founded firmly, so far, upon the official narrative of what happened on September 11th. The psychological trick at the heart of September 11th, by the way, is that people confuse their compassion for the victims with their certainty about who the perpetrators are. the public was presented with instant perpetrators. The trick will most likely continue working for all future planned invasions, looks as if Iraq is next, so long as the public remains blindfolded by the media. 9/11 serves the ends of the oligarchy. That does not in itself prove a connection between big oil and what happened on September 11th. But the fact that it does serve those ends must be taken together with other evidence, just part of which is the illegal importation, training, and protection of terrorists on U.S. soil by the CIA, the much-publicized failure of U.S. intelligence, the failure of the U.S. Air Force on the day, the inexplicable trades of United and American Airlines stocks in the days prior, the big economic difficulties the Bush administration was facing, and the looming Enron scandal. Next week, The Great Deception, Part 5.
Did you hear George Bush's high noon speech? You know, like 48 hours, Saddam, to get out of town, right? Remember that from a couple of weeks ago, right? And he also said, by the way, not only Saddam, but 48 hours for Saddam, inspectors, and journalists to leave, which is interesting. It's right in there. But he said this. He said, you know, let's go back to where this whole business started, our great victory, as we're celebrating our victory today. 2 weeks ago, our president said, I want to speak to the Iraqi people. And now Cheney forgot to mention that they speak Arabic. That's okay. Besides, a lot of, you know, parents of kids who are in the Gulf were listening in, so I thought he was going to say something like, you know, our kids are coming to liberate you, don't shoot them. Instead, he said, and I quote, do not destroy oil wells.
They want us to know. They want us to get the message, and it was just as blatant a message as November 22nd, 1963. I believe that 63's message is, yeah, we shot the son of a bitch. What do you want to do about it? We can kill the president. We sure as hell kill you. Sit down, shut up, and get out of the way. That's the subliminal message. And the subliminal message of this election is we done had about enough of this here democracy shit. We done already told you who won the election. Now set your whiny Democrat ass down and shut up. Get out of the way is the message. And I think they pulled up the petticoat and let us and let the rest of the world know. And that was reverberated for me right after September 11th. First week, a guy from the White House said, this war will last into the second Bush administration. We didn't elect him the first time. I guess we don't have to bother for the second time. Okay, but it was an open electoral coup. And he was in trouble. There was a global economic slump going on. The surplus was eroding in terms of the tax stuff. We were going back into a deficit situation. In June and July of last year, according to Times of India and the international press, Colin Powell visited Pakistan, India, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, the surrounding countries. This is June and July. And he told the heads of those countries and the people in the government that the United States was going to militarily intervene in mid-October to remove the Taliban. This is in June and July. This war in Afghanistan is not a response to 9/11. This is a war that, as all wars are, planned in advance. And it has to do with the fact that in 1999, a representative on foreign relations from the company called Unocal went to the Congress and told them that 80% of the world oil reserve would be in the Caspian Sea region 20 years from now. 80% of the remaining oil would be there, and that we had to get a pipeline down out of that region through Afghanistan into the sea, and that the Taliban had balked on taking the deal on that pipeline, and therefore the Taliban were in the way of our access to 80% of the world oil in the next few years, and they had to be removed. And that message was out. Now, it's interesting to me that Unocal said at that point they stopped their plans. A different company came in and started to make an alternate route across northern Afghanistan through Pakistan down to the sea. That company is called Enron. And Unocal is now back in the seat because Mr. Karzai was a consultant to Unocal, the head of Afghanistan, and the current ambassador of the United States from Afghanistan was an employee of Unocal. And the remaining five moderate leaders in Northern Alliance moderates, these guys were named in the New York Times 5 years ago as the largest opium dealers. So the oil is almost back in place. The heroin is already back in place. But what I'm telling you is that we were already going into Afghanistan with this plan before they hit any of these bumps. And then by late August, Bush clearly was getting into more trouble. He was having, his polls had gone down for popularity. He was having trouble getting elements of his domestic agenda through Congress. He was getting a lot of opposition from Daschle and Leahy and Feingold and some of the leading Democrats. The economy clearly was starting to fall. The tax deficit was rising because of his policies, and people were asking a lot of questions. And then there was a guy by the name of Kozak who had been in the State Department and was involved in the U.S. Ambassador role and in the State Department in Nicaragua, who had been an engineer of the Contra War there and part of the Contragate operation. And he, currently in the State Department back then, was over in Belarus or White Russia, conducting an operation of the same scale, they said in the papers, in order to influence a pending election in Belarus that might have taken out a pro-socialist government and put in a more reactionary government. And all that area, Belarus, I mean, that was where the major oil fields of the Soviet Union were located. And there's tremendous riches in that sector of the world, which is why there's such a focus now on getting at them. And Brzezinski, and if you go back and check his writings in the late 1980s, he says, once the Soviet Union falls, we've got to control that area up there. All the resources, all that cheap, trained labor is up there. And to get at it, we need to put military bases in Uzbekistan. And we just tripled the amount of aid to Uzbekistan, of course, again, with mostly military aid. And we're creating bases there. And I don't know if you read here in the local papers in the Bay Guardian, the way we create a base now is we hire Halliburton to take the base in a box with civilian personnel and guns, and they dump the base down and build the infrastructure, and the civilians guard it, and then the military comes into it. So that's one of the ways. I mean, and Halliburton bought out Brown and Root, which made $4 billion off of the construction they did in the Vietnam War. It was George Brown that financed LBJ into office. And then in turn, when LBJ reversed JFK's policy of withdrawal from Vietnam and went into the war, his political financiers made tremendous profits. And Cynthia McKinney, much to her chagrin and the loss of her election with the money that came out to defeat her, mentioned that, you know, perhaps it was worth questioning whether Bush and the people around him, most of which relate to the oil industry and munitions industry, might be making some profit off of the wars that they were taking us into and the kind of policies that they were taking us into. But that's not a legitimate question, apparently, for anybody in Congress to ask at this point.
Inhalation anthrax.
The potentially deadly bacteria.
U.S. warplanes.
Rats and mice. A lot of rats and mice.
Radios and televisions. Stereotypes of the Arab community.
Same conservative, mythic ideas of what an Arab person is that we've had for decades.
Just ask Wei Sudin, a remarkable 12-year-old boy living in the town of Rostock. He has only ever known war.
It's very difficult to live in. It is very difficult to live in war because the bombs came and high explosions around us. When the people and I heard the bomb, we go away.
But there's been war in your country for your whole lifetime.
Yeah.
Your whole life?
Yeah. From the time that I live, I can't see peace.
You never seen?
I can't see peace. Yeah, I can't see peace. I always say bombing. Yeah, I can't see peace. I always say bombing.
What do you think peace is like? What do you think a peaceful Afghanistan would be like?
Right now, I didn't see peace. I didn't see peace.
Can you imagine it?
Peace. I think peace is very good. Peace is opposite of war. I think war is not good. Peace is opposite of war. That is good. Because war is not good, it's good. I think it's good. Good.
rich and lucrative oil fields. The enormously rich and lucrative oil fields. Oil fields. The enormously rich and lucrative oil fields. The enormously rich and lucrative oil fields. Oil fields. Oil.
Afghanistan could prove the key. Oil fields. Oil.
The enormously rich and lucrative
oil fields. Oil fields. Oil. Afghanistan could prove the key to the enormously rich and lucrative oil fields in the former Soviet Central Asia in countries such as Tajikistan and Uzbekistan.
Why is that not talked about when everyone at any meeting talks about it away from the mainstream media?
I think that's a really good question, Bill. And I don't know the answer to it.
I think we both know the answer, probably.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. It's a kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
Maybe we can, in fact, take a view and see this as a war of conquest to take over further oil fields or something like that.
This heart is cold. He loves only gold.
There were no Afghans on those aeroplanes.
Only gold.
That were hijacked.
He loves gold.
One can trace a lot of the roots of this.
He loves only gold.
Back into Saudi Arabia.
Only gold.
The relations between the US and Saudi Arabia are very, very tense indeed at the moment, because there are still people in Saudi Arabia who support Osama bin Laden, and Saudi Arabia provides one of his principal recruiting grounds, let's face it. When we come to the causes of the Saudi, or indeed the Muslim or the Arab, whichever way one wants to look at it, discontent with the United States, you're on difficult thin ice, I think, because if we start talking about the reasons for the attack on the United States, this is assumed by many to be giving in to terrorism and to be somehow recognizing the demands of terrorism. But Osama bin Laden has stated it quite clearly. He is opposed to the US occupation of Saudi Arabia, to the propping up of unrepresentative and undemocratic regimes throughout the Arab world. He's opposed to the continued persecution of the Iraqi people by draconian United Nations sanctions, and of course to the continued plight of the Palestinians at the hands of the Israelis. These are all knee-jerk motherhood type issues throughout the Middle East, and he struck a rich nerve in raising these issues, because they're all things that the United States could do something about, but don't.
I'm watching, I'm at home winding down with my glass of wine, watching my TV, my own TV program the day after the election. Michael Moore's on instead of me. And I see one black person after another get up on the BBC television screen and say, I try to vote here in Florida, but my name, they wouldn't let me vote. My name was missing from the voter rolls, or they said I couldn't vote, I was an illegal voter. And one black face after another saying, I can't vote, I can't vote. And by the way, I should mention to you, for those who don't know this, BBC has a rule that we are allowed to show black people on camera who aren't criminals. And yeah, it's true. It's true. And so I'm looking at this, and in my conspiracy nut mind, and see, those of you, obviously, some of you have saw me on Politically Incorrect, where I was called a conspiracy nut, which, yeah, it's true. It always gets a laugh, you know, from the conspirators. And so I'm watching this, and so in my, you know, I just have this conspiracy nut idea that there's some type of computer program which is going through the voter rolls and erasing the names of black voters. And so I brought it for you tonight. It's from the offices of Catherine Harris from her Department of Elections. And here it is. Here it is. This is the list that elected your president. It's a list of, this is the real thing. This is, I got two silvery CD-ROMs. This is a list of 57,000 names of people who were removed, ordered to be removed from the voter rolls by Catherine Harris and her office. Okay? Now, there's a reason. Now, these are bad people. I just want to get you. There's a reason why they're removed. They're not nice. They're criminals. They're felons. They're people who have committed terrible crimes in Florida. And I was going down the list, and I see one here. It's one of the first things I saw. It says Thomas Cooper, who was convicted, and you can verify this if you come up later, convicted on January 30th, 2007. And, ooh, Catherine. See, and you thought Minority Report was just made up, right? It's like Catherine Harris, detective of the future, goes in and gets the bad guys and says, I know what you're going to do next year. Can't vote in Florida. 500 criminals of the future on this list. So BBC television and the Guardian papers, and led by my leading the team. First of all, we did something that no other American newspaper did. We asked for the list. So we actually start going through it. 90.2% of the people on this list are absolutely innocent. That's not correct. 54% of the people on this list are guilty of being black. See, there's the race of each voter right next to their name on the far right column. And now that's interesting. The effect, by the way, just of this list, and there are several others, four others that I know of. This cost Al Gore 20,000 votes here. Not everyone votes. Not everyone votes Gore. But there wasn't a big surge of black voters for Buchanan. No, because someone on the radio challenged me today on a right-wing radio show. Well, you're just assuming that black voters voted for Al Gore if they could vote, right? I said, well, believe me, if this was a list of country club, you know, guys at the Augusta Golf Club there, and they had lost their vote, do you think that we'd be discussing this? They would have gotten their vote back, right? But there's another interesting. So one of the questions is, this is the list that elected your president. The question was it a mistake? Which is the latest thing I've heard, a mistake. Or was it deliberate? So I did something unusual, which is, I don't think it's allowed under the USA Patriot Act. We actually investigated the matter by going into the email files. We actually got the email traffic from the Florida Department of Elections. And there were clerks who said, my God, we are eliminating voters of the future. I mean, criminals of the future. These people haven't been, you know, what is this, 2007, 3010? And the answer came back from the Republican functionaries. Now, I thought, hey, I went to L.A. public schools. The answer should be, well, what do? You give them back their vote, right? No, that's not very sophisticated. The answer was, if you blank out the conviction dates, no one will know. And there are 4,000 blank conviction dates, not convicted any time, anywhere on here.
September 11th has brought mostly unpleasant changes, including curtailment of civil liberties and threatened perpetual war, all rooted in the official story of what happened on September 11th. Namely, that one evil man and his network are responsible, and that the U.S. military, intelligence, and political establishments were all caught totally off guard. Millions of intelligent people accept this story as their own. Any argument about any aspect of the conduct of the war against terrorism, as Globe and Mail columnist John Ibbotson puts it, must begin with those airplanes smashing into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And then it must stay there and never move from that spot. If it's that important, and I agree it is, then it's the duty of the media and of intelligent citizens to inquire about any anomalies about September 11th. Today's question: what did George Bush know, and when did he know it, on September 11th?
Bush was first informed of the suicide attacks at an education event in Florida, his face creasing into anxiety. The crisis transformed his presidency.
This image, embedded in the official story, has led the world to believe that when Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, whispered into his ear at an elementary school at 9:05 that morning, it was the first the U.S. president learned that, in his words, America was under attack. But a growing number of people, including the careful researchers at emperorsclothes.com, don't think so. Using verifiable, publicly available information, Ilarion Baikov and Jared Israel, an intrepid Canadian, raise questions mainstream media stubbornly refuse to even acknowledge. Consider, Baikov and Israel say, the words of journalist John Cochrane, who was traveling with the president on the morning of September the 11th, on an ABC special report. Cochrane is speaking to Peter Jennings. Peter, as you know, the president's down in Florida talking about education. He got out of his hotel suite this morning, was about to leave. Reporters saw the White House chief of staff, Andy Card, whisper into his ear. The reporter said to the president, "Do you know what's going on in New York?" He said he did, and he said he will have something about it later. His first event is about half an hour at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. So Bush knew, writes Emperor's Clothes, about the first incident before leaving his hotel. Take other evidence. By 8:20, according to its own official report, the Federal Aviation Authority, the FAA, is fully aware of the unprecedented emergency in the skies. As Baikov and Israel point out, the President of the United States travels with an entire staff, including the Secret Service, which is responsible for his safety. The members of this support team have the best communications equipment in the world. They maintain contact with, or can easily reach, Bush's cabinet, the National Military Command Center and Pentagon, the FAA. In other words, around 8:46 at the absolute latest, the Secret Service and the President would have known of all four hijacked airliners and that one had hit the World Trade Center. That's two sets of proofs that question the famous whisper in the ear at 9:05. Still not convinced? How about the typically garbled words of the President himself? From the transcript of a town hall session in Orlando, Florida on December the 4th. Jordan, a third grader. How did you feel when you heard about the terrorist attack? Applause. The president. Thank you, Jordan. Well, Jordan, I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower. The TV was obviously on. And I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. And I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America is under attack. And Jordan, I wasn't sure what to think at first. Wait a minute. The president tells us he saw the incredible image of the first plane going in. He went ahead with an easily cancelable appointment. Why? He tells us he knew his country was under attack, yet he continued to listen to a student talk about her pet goat and such for another 25 minutes. Why? Where can you find that town hall transcript? On the White House website. Thanks to a viewer on the West Coast for drawing it to my attention. In other words, no matter how you cut it, George W. Bush is acting right here. There are many other facts equally puzzling, at least for anyone still clinging to the official story of 9/11. His schedule and whereabouts had been publicly announced. Why did the Secret Service not whisk him away for safety's sake? Do you think there's anything here that mainstream media should follow up? Have you noticed any such follow-up? Do you find this as incredible as I do? What will it take to snap people out of the hypnotic trance of the official story and start asking questions? Maybe you calling an editor and raising hell. Until the world finds out the truth about what really happened on September the 11th, the world is held hostage to the so-called war on terrorism. And surely it's time to recognize that for what it is. Harsh, final steps to what the U.S. military terms full spectrum dominance. Next week, judgment. The final installment of The Great Deception. Moral judgment. And spiritual
the,
challenges.
The U.S. attack against Nicaragua.
Judgment.
Killed tens of thousands of people.
Judgment.
Virtually destroyed the country. It may never recover.
The judgment.
And it was indeed condemned by the International Court of Justice as international terrorism, and in their words, unlawful use of force.
The judgment of lesser nations.
The U.S., of course, rejected the
judgment of lesser nations.
The U.S., of course, rejected the
judgment of lesser nations.
The U.S., of course, rejected
the judgment of lesser nations.
The U.S., of course, rejected the judgment with contempt and immediately escalated the war.
The American position is that they will not subject themselves to the judgment of lesser nations, which means simply everybody else.
The U.S., of course, rejected the judgment with contempt and immediately escalated the war to more direct terror, including official orders to attack what they're called soft targets, undefended civilian targets. Nicaragua went to the Security Council, which debated a resolution calling on all states to observe international law.
The American position is that they will not subject themselves to the judgment of...
The American position is that they will not subject themselves to the judgment of lesser nations, which means...
The American position is that they will not subject themselves to the judgment of...
The American position is that they will not subject themselves to the judgment of lesser nations, which means...
The United States vetoed it. So that one's uncontroversial, and in scale it's far beyond this.
President Bush said all nations had to unite to oppose all terrorists.
Any government that rejects this principle, trying to pick and choose its terrorist friends, will know the consequences.
We're doing the right thing. We're doing it the best way that we know how. We're adapting as we go along. We're confident that we're making progress, and we are going to win.
The Taliban and Al-Qaeda, the number of civilian deaths in the U.S. military campaign...
Inhalation anthrax.
Retribution. Terrorism.
Thousands of deaths.
Jihad or holy war.
Unexploded cluster bombs.
The war on terrorism.
The possibility of being hit by what's known as a dirty bomb.
I'm a bit of America.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a good recording, man.
When President Bush talks about a war on terrorism, does he mean a war on a generic phenomenon, or does he mean a specific war on the people responsible for this week's atrocity?
Well, I think there is quite a lot of ambiguity about what's meant. War or talk of war seems to satisfy a rather primal urge, which is perhaps understandable in the aftermath of a tragedy of such huge proportions, but...
War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. Love, love.
When it first happened, I could name 14 countries off the top of my head that could be responsible for this because of the policies that America has had towards them.
Yep.
The reasons Americans are saying why on earth do they hate us so much is because there is so much self-censorship in their own media. That self-censorship has caused them to have a level of ignorance about what's been going on.
Yeah, what's going on?
The evidence to connect Bin Laden specifically, and I guess his network more generally, to what happened in New York and Washington was very thin.
What? I suppose surprising from an international law perspective is there is already a considerable body of international law that prohibits terrorism, that prohibits financing, giving succor to terrorists, but the US has always rather disdained participation in those treaties.
The evidence to connect Bin Laden specifically, and I guess his network more generally, to what happened in New York and Washington was very thin.
When it first happened, I could name 14 countries off the top of my head that could be responsible for this because of the policies that America has had towards them.
We're we've had the alliance to some degree formed. We've had Tony Blair and George Bush communicating amongst the various heads of state and heads of government around the world, apparently showing them some sort of evidence. But as far as I'm aware, there is still no clear evidence out there in the public domain which is easily accessible and understandable.
And another two of those countries could be America itself. What's been going on?
We don't need to escalate.
So quite what this war on terrorism means is not clear.
War is not the answer.
What's been going on?
For only love can conquer.
When somebody said no, the way to respond is to try to get the terrorists and their culture to understand us. The response was, the only way to get them to love us is really is to bomb them. We bombed the Japanese, and that now they've grown to love us.
It's all very well to talk about the epicenter of world terrorism, but you talk about epicenter. The Americans talk about the epicenter as though it were Kabul. Now, obviously, if you're a Sri Lankan, the epicenter is the Jaffna Peninsula. If you're an Algerian, I don't know what the epicenter is. If you're a Turk, it's somewhere in the Kurdish community. If you're British, it's in Belfast. I mean, it's all very well to talk about the epicenter of world terrorism, but terrorism as a phenomenon, the criminal attack on defenseless civilians as though it were war, this has been going on for a long time, and America has been a patron of terrorism.
What's been going on?
Well, I'm frankly surprised by how thin the evidence is. I mean, there is a prima facie case, and in those early interviews, I simply took for granted that it was probably the Bin Laden network or else something very much like it. Although whether he himself was involved, nobody knows. I mean, there was essentially no evidence presented. I mean, the U.S. and Britain decided, for whatever reason, to let Tony Blair present the evidence, with the U.S. government standing in behind it. But it must be the same evidence. They wouldn't have presented it without using whatever the U.S. had been able to obtain. This has been, you know, surely the most intensive investigative effort in history, including all the Western intelligence agencies and many others. And they have been able to come up with very little, very little.
You are listening to The Fish Show and our presentation of Spoken Word relating to the events leading up to and the aftermath of September 11th. A little bit different view on the official story. Only got about 15 minutes left, and we've got a few more things to do, so we're going to crowd it all in tonight. Thank you for phoning in, and congratulations to all the winners. We gave away some DVDs tonight, and that's good. Free stuff. You are listening to The Fish Show.
I asked the question in 1996, are you scared yet? Because in Europe, from the end of World War II forward, with U.S., CIA, and other intelligence-backed operations like Gladio and Propaganda Due, there were plans put in effect there and eventually brought here. But from the 40s on, there was this agent provocateur kind of situations. And they carried on these operations, and now we know from documents related to, in Bamford's new book, Body of Secrets, that Operation Northwoods and General Lemnitzer, who was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on November 22nd, 63, had plans to create terrorist incidents or simulated terrorist incidents in the United States that could be blamed on Castro and Cuba as an excuse to go to war with Cuba, including crashing commercial planes full of people. This is the 1960s that the Pentagon is thinking about, actively thinking about, and carrying through these things. And, of course, the cost of all this is civil liberties and the establishment of permanent war, a permanent war economy. We were told that we were going into a 10-year war the first week after September the 11th. Now, that resonated to me because my mother projected the draft call figures 5 years in advance. She had to project them accurately enough within 100 people either way in the annual national call that went up to 50,000 people. She had tables. How many will retire? How many will reenlist? How many will enlist anew? How many will discharge under each category? And if there was going to be a war, she had attrition levels that she was given. How many will die? How many will be wounded? How many will discharge for medical conditions? How many do we have now? How many do we want down the pike? How many do we have to draft each year to get there? Then they would take those figures that my mother came up with, accurate enough within 100 people either way that far ahead, and they would multiply them by five. And they would give that to the draft boards as their quota. Why? Because 50 to 55% will flunk a physical, 10 to 15% will get a deferment or exemption from the draft, and 10 to 15% will no-show and resist, and we're back down to the 20% we wanted in the first place. This is planning, folks. So I asked my mother. She retired in 1973. She was not happy with the war in Vietnam. When she finally retired, she'd been a pacifist between the wars, but thought you had to fight Hitler, and then thought you had to fight communism, the same as Hitler. But Vietnam and the level of civilian deaths and the weapons freaked her out, as they should have. Civilian death in World War I is 4%. Non-combat-related World War II deaths, 25%. Korea, 54%. Vietnam, 94%. That means in modern warfare, collateral damage is the combat troop. Get it straight when you're talking about going to war. It's not soldiers that are going to be dying in the large amount. It's civilians. It's families and it's civilians because of the nature of the war and the nature of the weapons. So I asked her, when did they tell you that they would escalate the war in Vietnam? Because she had to be among the first to know. She said that in April of 1963, for the first time in her career, she was given orders to change her projections. They were from the White House. They were orders from John F. Kennedy. They were orders to change the projections in Southeast Asia, specifically in Vietnam, for a full withdrawal of American troops by the end of 1964. A full withdrawal by the end of 1964. I said, when did they turn around? When did they tell you they would escalate in Vietnam? She said, late November. I said, the last week in November, Kennedy's killed on the 22nd. She said, the Monday following the assassination. Kennedy barely in the grave. I said, was this just a few more advisors? She said, I couldn't believe the figures. I took them back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I said, these can't be right. And I used to tease my mother afterwards that that was the first civilian protest to the war in Vietnam. November 25, 1963, they told my mother they were going into a 10-year war in Vietnam with 57,000 American dead. That's where they went. That's how long it took them. So when they told me September 11th, we're going into a 10-year war, I know that they plan wars that way. Then after that, we were told by Rumsfeld that it was a war that may not end in our lifetime. Just in the last week and a half, we've been told that it's a 60-year war. This is a world war. There's no other name for this. This is a war that almost, through its destabilization of situations in Afghanistan, led to a nuclear war in Pakistan and India. We're in a world that's too interconnected to go playing these games. Things fall apart. If we erode the international balance, everyone else will erode the international balance. This is a world war. And it's up to the American people to stop this madness. There's no one else left in the world with the power that the American people have to bring this machinery to a halt. There's no other country that has the capability to stop this genocidal machine. What's been done that led to the events of 9/11, with or without U.S. complicity, has been done in our name for the last 50 years, and we're suffering the consequences. We're going to live the consequences of whatever's decided now. Should it be decided in secret behind a closed door by Mr. Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush, or is it a decision that belongs to the American people? This is a decision that belongs to a real democracy. And it has to be. There was a paradigm shift that day. Another quote from Rumsfeld, this war will secure American interests abroad for decades to come. Charles Krauthammer the other day, the reactionary neocon columnist in the Washington Post, pressed by others on an NBC talk show to give a valid reason to go to Iraq, finally blurted out, there will be a tremendous financial windfall for the United States when we seize their oil. It's about resources. It's about what Buckminster Fuller called in the last book, Grunch, gross universal cash heist. It's about an alignment of a real axis of evil on September the 11th, and after that, an alignment of the United States, Europe, and the globalized corporations and their control through the World Bank and the IMF of the neoliberal model countries that they are corrupting and taking over the resources and the labor of and the wannabes. Russia is the first country to call Bush with an offer to help. China jumped into the World Trade Organization September the 12th. That's what's aligned against what? The underdeveloped countries and the pockets of resistance that remain in the neoliberal countries and us. That's why we're terrorists, because we don't fit the model. I mean, we can be good Germans, perhaps, and a few of us can go along, but only a few of us, because there's not that much to go around when you concentrate wealth at this tremendous level. We're going into permanent war economy, deficit, economic slump, an end to Social Security and social services, increased secrecy, a curbing of civil rights. I believe that we are at a crossroad in human history. I agree with Leonard Cohen in the song The Future that love is the only engine of human survival. I think that to pick up a weapon in the 21st century means that you lack imagination. You can't beat them at that gun game, that violence game. It doesn't go anywhere. If you don't know how to use your head and your heart to win, you'll lose. This is what Dr. King was talking about. And we need to decentralize power. We need to give people back their power, because not only are they separated from their history and don't know where they are, but they also are taught that they have no power. They're taught that it's impossible to do anything. But in fact, there's much that we can do. Rights are inalienable. They are conceptual. They are on paper. And even when they take them away on paper, they don't take them away up here. Even when they destroy the word in the dictionary, they can't really destroy the concept. And if we use our rights, they become our rights. So if they want to make it more secret, we should try to make it more open. If they say you don't have a right, we should use the right. We are now faced, said Dr. King, with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfinished conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing here, naked and dejected, with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain in the flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is deaf to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. There is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. We still have a choice today: nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. This may well be mankind's last chance to choose between chaos and community.
And that brings me to the conclusion of my series, The Great Deception. The editors at the New York Times made the right judgment call, in my opinion, by playing this story at the top of their front page recently. Because government deception is a moral issue. But in a way, these headlines are laughable by including phrases such as "readies efforts" and "proposes to send false news." Are readers supposed to believe the Pentagon might start lying? The Pentagon was caught lying about the thousands of civilian deaths in Panama in 1989.
The U.S. military said 250 civilians were killed. I mean, there isn't a credible source in Panama that believes that's true. Whether it's ambulance drivers, human rights monitors, people, doctors who worked in hospitals, neighbors of bombed out blocks, it's just clearly false. That story would be so easy to tell for any journalist worth his or her salt, but they're not telling it.
Back to the Times article. The odd thing about it is that you can go over it with a divining rod and find that neither the writers nor anyone they quote makes so much as a passing reference to the simple wrongness of government lying. Not once are the words moral, morality, ethics, or such used, let alone lies or lying. In my moral book, publishing a story with morality at its heart without mentioning the word is committing the sin of omission. The story also accepts foolish statements about Saddam Hussein and prints them with a straight face, as it were. It's claimed he has a charm offensive going on. I don't know about you, but I've noticed the offensive part, but not the charm part. And we haven't done anything to counteract it, a senior military official said. Well, if you don't count the U.S. government's all-out propaganda campaign against the Iraqi leader for more than a decade, then I guess this guy's got a point. Readers are also misled to focus on side issues, such as public perceptions, strategy, possible illegality, and bureaucratic turf wars. This article, representing the creme de la creme of U.S. journalism, symbolizes how disconnected the U.S. media and government have become from moral questions, one might almost say from reality. To give credit where credit's due, the Times ran an editorial terming the Pentagon's proposed new Office of Strategic Influence Orwellian. Yet, the editorial fails as well to question the fundamental justness of the Pentagon, which brings me to my main point. The less people ask themselves questions about deceit, the more it clears the way for organizations such as the CIA to continue to receive seemingly unending billions of dollars. Taxpayer money used to train terrorists, as the CIA acknowledges it has, to destabilize governments, as former CIA agent John Stockwell writes in his book, In Search of Enemies, and to inject toxic gray, white, and black propaganda into the world's information systems, as William Bloom spells out in Killing Hope, all with barely a whisper of dissent. The lie, wrote theologian André Dumas, is biblically portrayed as the first and most poisonous source of injustice. Truth-telling, he wrote, is absolutely essential to the very life and health of the whole community, which is at the heart of the Great Deception about what really happened on September 11th. For the past 5 weeks, I've asked questions. How could it be that no U.S. Air Force jet interceptors turned a wheel on September the 11th until it was too late? Is it coincidence that the war on Afghanistan triggered by September 11th will clear the way for petroleum pipelines of huge interest to the White House? How to explain the virtual non-reaction of President Bush immediately following the planes slamming into the World Trade Center? These marked-up passages are from my dog-eared copy of a gem of a book, The Idea of Disarmament, Rethinking the Unthinkable, by Alan Geyer. Geyer, in 1982, writes, "The nuclear arms race has become this generation's severest test of truth. It is zealously promoted with false words, deceptive jargon, pretentious dogmatics, hateful propaganda, and arbitrary bars on access to the truth. No realm of public policy is more corrupted by untruthful speech than national security. Today, the big lie of the so-called war on terrorism, itself firmly based on the linchpin of the implausible official version of what happened on September 11th, is an even more severe test of truth, in my opinion. Under the banner of the war on terrorism, George W. Bush, with the aid of the media, zealously promotes perpetual global war in service of resource looting and permanent popularity for himself. There's unprecedented militarism. The USA is spending more than half its budget on wars past, present, and future, according to the Center for Defense Information. As Christian humanist Geyer writes, in words truer today, in my view, than when written, demythologizing has become the indispensable theological tool of peacemaking. It is the operation empowering the people of God to understand the stratagems by which inhuman speech violates the word of God. Those stratagems include a relentless outpouring of myths about weapons, strategy, security, enemies, history, and human nature, from government bureaucracies and adjunct think tanks and co-opted media and electronic theologians. And in this gem of a book, I find the perfect conclusion to this series about what really happened on September 11th, about the Great Deception, about moral and spiritual challenges amidst fear and denial. In the 1930s, there was a powerful peace movement. At that time, a play by Viennese poet Stefan Zweig was produced. The play's principal character, Jeremiah, bursts forth with these words, "Peace is not a thing of weakness. It calls for heroism and action. Day by day, you must wrest it from the mouths of liars. You must stand alone against the multitude, for clamor is always on the side of the many, and the liar has ever the first word. The meek must be strong."
you have been listening to The Fish Show. Tonight we were playing bits and pieces of an alternative view of September 11th and the aftermath thereof. Coming up during the fall, I'll be playing other bits and pieces that I've amassed over the summer, and I hope you enjoyed tonight. Tonight is available on the internet as of a couple days from now. Go to CFUV, hit the show links, hit The Fish Show, and you can download from there. I'm sure you could find it. I want to thank Gorge Video for giving me a couple DVDs to give away, and congratulations to all winners, all the wieners. Coming up is the Willpower Show. We'll see you next week.
Good night.
Good night, boys and girls.
Get ready.
Cassette, boy.
Album.
Parker.
Tapes.
Coming soon.
The U.S. is terrorist.
America. They've never stopped bombing in Iraq. Tell me what, that's really dark. 1,500,000 Iraqis died.
Remember Iraq, remember Iran.
It blow up New York, it blow up New York.
Fly an aeroplane in the New York streets.
Blow up the World Trade Center, commit suicide like my man from Afghanistan.
Fly me to New York. I've got a razor in my pocket. You think you've flown before? Wait till you lock in my plane. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding my knife deep in the heart of you. I'm round the bend, I'm mental, and I'm flying the plane. Let's fly into buildings. Let's turn to ashes, 'cause I'm dying on a jet plane. I know I won't be back again.
World Trade Center.
And now my skin is melting away.
Look, here comes another aeroplane.
The WTC
burns like a tower in inferno.
We burn twin towers.
Let the motherfucker burn.
Buildings knocked down,
down to the ground.
Buildings collapse, creating casualties.
World Trade Center
buried you alive.
Dismembered bodies at ground zero.
To blame.
America.
There's no one but yourself to blame.
Let's talk about war over oil. Let's talk about the oil. Let's talk about the needs for the oil in the U.S. soil.